When the lights go out, they speak. The vanished, the cursed, the cruel. Their echoes live here. I'm Raven Vale, and you've just crossed the threshold. Welcome to Whispers from the Dark. Whispers from the Dark, the smiley face killer. I am Raven Vale, and tonight, the whispers from the dark carry the cold, damp scent of the Mississippi River, a mighty ancient artery that carves its way through the very heart of America. It is a river of commerce and beauty, of history and legend, but for a chilling span of years, it became something far more sinister, a silent, relentless accomplice to an unsettling, terrifying pattern of death. Our journey into this profound enigma begins not in a single, isolated incident, but in a series of deeply disturbing disappearances and subsequent discoveries that began to ripple, like dark, concentric circles, across the placid surface of Midwestern life. The late 1990s and early 2000s ushered in an era of unsettling tranquility, a period where the greatest fears for many young Americans revolved around academic pressures or social anxieties. Yet, beneath this seemingly calm veneer, a chilling undercurrent was beginning to stir, particularly in the vibrant, youthful college towns nestled along the vast, winding expanse of the Mississippi River. Consider La Crosse, Wisconsin, a picturesque city cradled by towering bluffs and bisected by the very river that would become so tragically synonymous with its darkest fears. La Crosse, like many river towns, possessed a lively, bustling nightlife, its downtown streets often teeming with exuberant college students from the University of Wisconsin, La Crosse and Viterbo University. On any given weekend night, the bars and pubs along its historic avenues pulsed with youthful energy, laughter, and the carefree camaraderie of friends. These were places of innocent revelry, where young men and women gathered to unwind, to connect, to celebrate the fleeting joys of early adulthood. But for a disturbing number of young men, these nights of innocent fun would culminate in a horrifying, inexplicable vanishing act. The pattern, initially dismissed as tragic, isolated accidents, began to solidify with a grim, relentless regularity. A young man, typically in his early 20s, would enjoy a night out with friends, perhaps have a few drinks, and then, in the early hours of the morning, simply disappear. His friends, initially concerned, would assume he had gone home, or perhaps to another party. But as the hours stretched into days, and the days into agonizing weeks, a frantic, desperate search would ensue. Posters bearing hopeful, smiling faces would appear on every lamppost, every storefront, their bright visages a stark, heartbreaking contrast to the growing despair of their families. Then, with a sickening, predictable regularity, the bodies would be found. Almost invariably, they were recovered from the cold, murky depths of the Mississippi River, or one of its connecting waterways. The causes of death were consistently ruled as drowning, often with alcohol as a contributing factor. The official explanations pointed to accidental falls, perhaps exacerbated by intoxication, a tragic consequence of youthful exuberance meeting the unforgiving currents of the river. And for a time, this grim narrative was accepted, albeit with a heavy heart. These were deemed unfortunate, isolated accidents, a somber reminder of the dangers of late-night wandering near powerful waterways. But as the list of names grew, as the number of young, vibrant lives extinguished in such a similar, perplexing manner mounted, a chilling unease began to settle over these river communities. Luke Homan, a promising 21-year-old from La Crosse, vanished after a night out in October 2006, his body found in the river weeks later. Just months before, in April 2006, 20-year-old Craig Ewalt, also from La Crosse, disappeared under eerily similar circumstances. His body, too, recovered from the river. The names accumulated. Michael Knoll, Jared Dussault, Dakota James, Christopher Jenkins, Patrick McNeil, a growing, tragic roster of young men whose promising futures were abruptly, mysteriously cut short by the river's cold embrace. The similarities were too stark, too unsettling, to ignore indefinitely. All were young, athletic, and academically engaged. Many were last seen leaving bars late at night, and almost all were found in bodies of water, often with no signs of struggle, no obvious foul play, and bewilderingly, no witnesses to their final, terrifying moments. The official narrative of accidental drowning, while plausible for an isolated incident, began to strain under the weight of so many eerily similar tragedies. A creeping suspicion, a chilling, unspoken question, began to permeate the collective consciousness of these river towns. Was this truly a series of unfortunate accidents, or was something far more sinister, far more deliberate, at play? The river itself, once a symbol of life and connection, began to take on a more ominous character. Its dark, swirling currents seemed to hold a terrifying secret. Its vast, silent expanse, a grim repository for lost dreams and unanswered prayers. The communities, initially resilient in their grief, found themselves gripped by a pervasive, unsettling fear. Parents began to warn their children with a new urgency, a desperate plea for caution in the face of an unseen, elusive threat. The carefree nights that once defined these college towns began to feel tinged with a palpable anxiety, a chilling awareness that the darkness held more than just shadows. This was the unsettling backdrop against which a terrifying theory would soon emerge, a theory that would attempt to connect these disparate, heartbreaking tragedies into a single, horrifying narrative. A narrative that would suggest these were not accidents, but the calculated chilling work of an unseen predator, leaving behind a grim, enigmatic signature. The stage was set for the whispers to grow louder, for the dark currents of speculation to pull us deeper into the heart of a truly terrifying conspiracy. The river holds its secrets tightly, but sometimes, if you listen closely enough, its whispers become a chilling roar. I am Raven Vale, and the chilling currents of the Mississippi, once merely a backdrop to these tragedies, now begin to carry a more sinister implication. For it was in the unsettling uniformity of these deaths that a terrifying, audacious theory began to take shape, a whisper that would soon escalate into a contentious, unsettling roar across the nation's true crime landscape. As the list of drowned young men grew, stretching from the tranquil banks of La Crosse, Wisconsin, down to the bustling urban centers further south, a small, determined group of retired law enforcement officers and forensic experts began to connect the seemingly disparate dots. Led by the tenacious, often outspoken figures of Kevin Gannon, a former NYPD detective, and Dr. Lee Gilbertson, a criminal justice professor, they refused to accept the prevailing narrative of mere accidental drownings. Their collective intuition, honed by decades of confronting the darkest aspects of human nature, screamed that something far more insidious was at play. Their meticulous, painstaking review of dozens of these cases revealed a disturbing, almost identical modus operandi. The victims were almost exclusively young, white, athletic males, often college students, who had been out drinking with friends. They would vanish late at night, typically after leaving a bar, and their bodies would later be recovered from a nearby body of water, rivers, lakes, canals. Crucially, in many of these cases, there was a puzzling lack of evidence of struggle, no defensive wounds, and often, despite the presence of alcohol, no clear explanation for how they entered the water. The official rulings of accidental drowning, while convenient, felt increasingly inadequate to these seasoned investigators. But it was a particular, chilling detail that truly cemented their controversial theory. The discovery of graffiti depicting a crude, unsettling smiley face near the locations where several of the bodies were recovered. This seemingly innocuous symbol, often found spray-painted on bridges, walls, or even utility poles, transformed from simple vandalism into a terrifying potential signature. For Gannon and his team, these grinning, malevolent faces were not random acts of urban art. They were defiant, mocking taunts left by a calculating, unseen predator, or, more chillingly, a coordinated group of killers. The theory, which quickly became known as the Smiley Face Killer conspiracy, posited that these deaths were not accidents, but homicides orchestrated by an organized group. This group, they argued, would target young men, abduct them, and then dispose of their bodies in water, leaving the distinctive smiley face graffiti as a morbid calling card. The motive remained elusive, shrouded in the terrifying anonymity of the perpetrators, but the pattern, they insisted, was undeniable. This was not the work of a single, deranged individual, but a network operating with chilling precision across multiple states, leaving a trail of grief and unanswered questions in their wake. The implications were staggering and immediately met with fierce skepticism and outright dismissal from many official law enforcement agencies, including the FBI. The prevailing view among federal and local authorities was that these were indeed tragic, alcohol-related drownings, often exacerbated by cold water shock or hypothermia. They argued that the presence of graffiti was coincidental, a common urban phenomenon, and that attempting to link disparate deaths across vast geographical areas based on such tenuous evidence was irresponsible and misleading. The FBI, in particular, issued statements asserting that they had found no evidence to support the existence of a smiley face killer, serial killer, or group. Yet, for the families of the victims, and for Gannon's team, the official dismissals felt like a cruel injustice. They saw a pattern that authorities refused to acknowledge, a chilling connection that cried out for deeper investigation. They pointed to cases like that of Christopher Jenkins, a 21-year-old University of Minnesota student whose body was found in the Mississippi River in Minneapolis in 2002. Initially ruled an accidental drowning, Jenkins's case was later reclassified as a homicide after a private investigation, though no arrests were ever made. This reclassification, for proponents of the smiley face theory, was a powerful validation of their claims, a tangible crack in the official narrative. The controversy raged, fueled by media attention, documentaries, and fervent online communities. Proponents of the theory highlighted additional unsettling details: cell phones often missing or never recovered, toxicology reports sometimes showing drugs that could incapacitate a victim, and the baffling distances some victims seemed to travel before entering the water. They argued that the sheer number of similar deaths, particularly in regions with active nightlife and proximity to water, defied statistical probability for accidental drownings alone. But the most terrifying aspect of the smiley face killer theory lay in its suggestion of an organized, elusive group. The idea of multiple perpetrators operating silently and efficiently, leaving behind a mocking symbol, sent shivers down the spines of parents and communities alike. It transformed the random tragedy of an accidental fall into the calculated horror of targeted abduction and murder. It painted a grim picture of a hidden menace, lurking in the shadows of seemingly safe college towns, preying on the unsuspecting, and leaving a chilling, grinning mark of their sinister triumph. The river continues its relentless flow, but now, for many, its dark waters are forever tainted by the unsettling image of a crude, smiling face, a silent, mocking testament to an enduring, terrifying mystery. I am Raven Vale, and the river's cold embrace continues to tighten around our collective consciousness. As the unsettling theory of the smiley face killer gained a terrifying foothold, the individual tragedies that once seemed isolated began to coalesce into a horrifying mosaic, each piece a lost life, each outline a chilling question mark. The grim pattern, once a faint whisper, now screamed with agonizing clarity for those who dared to listen. Beyond the initial cluster of disappearances in La Crosse, the same chilling narrative began to unfold in other river towns, painting a wider, more terrifying canvas of potential serial predation. Consider the heart-wrenching case of Christopher Jenkins, a bright, promising 21-year-old student at the University of Minnesota. On Halloween night in 2002, Christopher vanished after leaving a bar in downtown Minneapolis. His friends, initially unconcerned, quickly spiraled into frantic despair as days turned into weeks with no sign of him. Months later, in February 2003, his body was discovered in the icy, unforgiving waters of the Mississippi River, just blocks from where he was last seen. Initially, Minneapolis police, like so many other departments, ruled his death an accidental drowning, citing alcohol consumption. But Christopher's parents, driven by an unyielding, desperate love, refused to accept this facile explanation. Their relentless, private investigation, fueled by a mother's intuition and a father's fierce determination, uncovered inconsistencies that forced authorities to reclassify his death as a homicide. While no arrests were ever made, and the case remains officially unsolved, the reclassification was a powerful, if bittersweet, validation for the proponents of the smiley face theory, a stark crack in the official wall of denial. Then there was the deeply disturbing disappearance of Patrick McNeil in April 2007 from the vibrant, bustling streets of Chicago. A 21-year-old student at the University of Illinois at Chicago, Patrick was last seen leaving a bar in the city's Lincoln Park neighborhood. His disappearance triggered a massive, agonizing search. Weeks later, his body was pulled from the murky waters of the Chicago River. Again, the familiar, chilling refrain: accidental drowning. Yet Patrick's family, like Christopher Jenkins's, found the explanation profoundly unsatisfying. They pointed to the fact that Patrick was a strong swimmer, and the circumstances of his disappearance, no witnesses, no struggle, a baffling entry into a heavily trafficked urban waterway, mirrored so many other cases. The discovery of a crudely drawn smiley face near where Patrick was last seen only intensified the family's conviction that something far more sinister had occurred. The emotional toll on these families was, and remains, immeasurable. Each official pronouncement of accidental drowning felt like a dismissive slap, a denial of their deepest fears and the unsettling anomalies they perceived. They were forced to become amateur detectives, poring over case files, hiring private investigators, and desperately seeking connections that law enforcement often refused to acknowledge. The grief of losing a child is an unbearable burden, but the added torment of not knowing how or why they died, of suspecting a malevolent hand at play, is a special kind of hell. Their lives became a relentless, agonizing crusade for truth, a desperate fight against official indifference and the pervasive, unsettling silence of the river. The debate surrounding the smiley face killer theory became a fierce, often acrimonious battleground. On one side stood the proponents, Gannon, Gilbertson, and the heartbroken families, armed with their pattern analysis, the unsettling graffiti, and the sheer volume of similar, perplexing deaths. They argued that the commonalities were too striking, too numerous, to be mere coincidence. They highlighted the consistent demographic of the victims, the typical time of disappearance, the consistent watery discovery, and the baffling lack of traditional forensic evidence. For them, the smiley faces were not simply random tags. They were a chilling, defiant signature, a mocking gesture left by a cunning, organized group. They believed that law enforcement's reluctance to embrace the theory stemmed from a fear of widespread panic and the daunting implications of a multi-jurisdictional serial killer group. On the opposing side, official agencies, particularly the FBI, maintained their steadfast position. They dismissed the smiley face killer theory as a sensationalized urban legend, a product of confirmation bias and misinterpretation. They argued that young men, particularly those who have consumed alcohol, are tragically prone to accidental falls into water, especially in urban environments with numerous waterways and active nightlife. They pointed to the lack of direct forensic evidence linking the cases, the absence of eyewitness accounts of abduction, and the highly speculative nature of the graffiti as a definitive signature. For them, the smiley faces were simply common graffiti, and attempting to link disparate deaths across hundreds, even thousands of miles based on such a tenuous connection was irresponsible and scientifically unfounded. They emphasized that each death, while tragic, should be investigated individually, on its own merits, rather than being forced into a preconceived, unproven narrative. The public, caught between these two opposing narratives, found themselves in a state of unsettling uncertainty. The media, hungry for compelling stories, often amplified the more sensational aspects of the smiley face killer theory, further fueling public fascination and fear. Online forums buzzed with amateur sleuths, dissecting every detail, every new disappearance, searching for patterns, for clues, for any glimmer of truth that might pierce the pervasive darkness. The theory became a modern urban legend, a chilling tale whispered in hushed tones, a grim reminder that even in the most familiar of settings, unseen dangers might lurk. And so the river flows on, a silent, powerful witness to these unresolved tragedies. Its dark waters continue to hold their secrets. But for those who have lost so much, the unsettling image of a crude, grinning face remains, a constant, chilling reminder of a mystery that refuses to be forgotten. I am Raven Vale, and the relentless flow of the river whispers of more than just water. It speaks of chilling patterns, of unseen hands, and of a relentless pursuit for answers that continues to defy the official narrative. The grim mosaic of lost lives stretches far beyond the initial heartbreaking clusters, revealing a terrifyingly widespread phenomenon that demands deeper scrutiny. The unsettling pattern, once confined to a few isolated river towns, began to manifest with alarming regularity across a vast geographical expanse, painting a truly terrifying picture of a potential unseen menace. Consider the deeply disturbing case of Todd Geib, a vibrant 22-year-old student from Michigan State University. In October 2005, Todd vanished after attending a party in East Lansing. His disappearance, like so many others, triggered a desperate, agonizing search by family and friends. Months later, his body was discovered in a secluded, wooded area, far from any major waterway. But the circumstances of his death remained profoundly mysterious. While not a drowning, the perplexing nature of his disappearance, the lack of immediate clues, and the sheer inexplicability of his final moments resonated with the chilling ambiguity of the river deaths. For many, Todd's case, with its baffling lack of resolution, felt like another piece of a larger, darker puzzle, suggesting a predator or group capable of operating beyond the immediate vicinity of water. Then there was the haunting disappearance of Michael Knoll from Minneapolis, a 22-year-old who vanished in October 2002 after leaving a bar. His body was found in the Mississippi River nearly a month later. Like Christopher Jenkins, Michael's death was initially ruled an accidental drowning, a familiar, almost dismissive conclusion that offered little comfort or explanation to his bewildered family. The consistency of these initial rulings, despite the perplexing circumstances, only deepened the suspicions of those who believed a more sinister hand was at work. The river, they argued, was being used as a convenient, silent grave, washing away the evidence of a more violent truth. These accumulating tragedies, each one a devastating blow to a loving family, fueled the unwavering resolve of the retired law enforcement professionals who dared to challenge the official narrative. Kevin Gannon, the former NYPD detective, with his grizzled experience and sharp, analytical mind, became a relentless voice for the victims. He had seen the darkest corners of humanity during his long career, and the recurring patterns in these cases screamed of something far more sinister than mere accidents. He was joined by Dr. Lee Gilbertson, a keen-eyed criminal justice professor from St. Cloud State University, whose academic rigor provided a crucial framework for analyzing the statistical anomalies of these deaths. Their collaboration was a formidable, if often embattled, force against the prevailing skepticism. Their methodology was meticulous, almost obsessive. They pored over hundreds of case files, cross-referencing details, seeking out the subtle commonalities that others dismissed as coincidental. They meticulously mapped out the locations of disappearances and body recoveries, noting the chilling proximity of the infamous smiley face graffiti. They interviewed grieving families, desperate for answers, and often found themselves validating the family's own gut feelings that something was profoundly wrong with the official conclusions. They looked for the why, the motive behind such seemingly random, yet eerily similar, acts of violence. One of their most compelling, yet controversial, arguments centered on the consistent lack of defensive wounds on the victims. If these young men were falling accidentally into the river, or even struggling against a current, one might expect scrapes, bruises, or other signs of a desperate fight for survival. Yet, time and again, the bodies recovered showed remarkably few external injuries consistent with a struggle. This led Gannon and his team to hypothesize that the victims were either incapacitated before entering the water, perhaps drugged or rendered unconscious, or that they were held in a way that prevented them from fighting back effectively. The idea of incapacitation was particularly chilling, suggesting a level of planning and control by the perpetrators. They also pointed to the perplexing distances some victims were found from their last known locations. How could an intoxicated person stumbling from a bar manage to travel several miles, often through unfamiliar terrain or across difficult urban landscapes, only to end up in a remote section of a river? These geographical anomalies, they argued, hinted at transportation by a third party, a chilling indication that the victims were not simply wandering lost. The river, in this terrifying scenario, became the final destination, not the accidental endpoint of a drunken stumble. The group also delved into the psychological profile of the potential perpetrators. They theorized that the smiley face killer or group might be driven by a desire for power, control, or a twisted sense of ritual. The crude, defiant smiley faces, they argued, were not just random tags, but a deliberate mocking signature, a psychological game played with law enforcement and the grieving families. It was a taunt, a declaration of their unseen presence and their chilling ability to operate with impunity. This suggested a level of sophistication and psychological deviance far beyond that of a typical accidental death. Despite their tireless efforts, their passionate appeals, and the growing public awareness their work generated, the official stance remained largely unchanged. The FBI continued to classify these deaths as unrelated, tragic accidents. This persistent dismissal, however, only solidified the conviction of Gannon and his team, and the heartbroken families, that they were battling not just an elusive killer, but also a systemic reluctance to acknowledge a terrifying, inconvenient truth. The river, with its dark, swirling currents, continued to hide its secrets. But the whispers from the dark grew louder, carried by the desperate cries for justice and the chilling, grinning image of a smiley face. The search for truth, like the river itself, is a relentless, winding journey, often fraught with unseen dangers and profound, unsettling mysteries. And sometimes, the most terrifying truths are the ones that refuse to be officially acknowledged. I am Raven Vale, and the relentless current of the river, once a silent witness, now carries the echoes of a fierce, unending debate. The smiley face killer theory, born from agonizing loss and relentless speculation, has carved its own indelible mark upon the American psyche, a chilling modern legend that refuses to be dismissed. As the theory gained traction, amplified by television documentaries, true crime podcasts, and the voracious appetite of online communities, it transcended mere investigative speculation to become a pervasive cultural phenomenon. The image of the crude, grinning, smiley face, once an obscure piece of graffiti, transformed into a sinister symbol, instantly recognizable and deeply unsettling. It tapped into primal fears, the vulnerability of young people, the unseen dangers lurking in seemingly safe environments, and the terrifying possibility of an organized, elusive evil operating with chilling impunity. Parents across the Midwest, and indeed the nation, began to warn their children with a new, desperate urgency, their voices tinged with the anxiety of an unseen threat. The carefree nights of college towns, once synonymous with youthful abandon, now carried a palpable undercurrent of dread, a chilling awareness that the darkness held more than just shadows. The media, often drawn to the more sensational aspects of the story, played a significant role in its widespread dissemination. News reports frequently highlighted the eerie similarities between cases, the baffling lack of traditional evidence, and the passionate arguments of Gannon and his team. While some outlets maintained a cautious, skeptical tone, others embraced the narrative with an almost breathless enthusiasm, fueling public fascination and, inevitably, public fear. The theory became a grim cautionary tale, a stark reminder that even in the most idyllic of settings, unimaginable horrors could unfold without warning or explanation. However, the smiley face killer theory has always been and remains a deeply controversial subject, met with fierce criticism and outright dismissal from a significant portion of the law enforcement and academic communities. Critics, including many seasoned homicide detectives and forensic experts, argue that the theory is a classic example of confirmation bias, the tendency to interpret new evidence as confirmation of one's existing beliefs. They contend that Gannon and Gilbertson are forcing disparate, unrelated tragedies into a preconceived narrative, cherry-picking details that fit their theory while ignoring those that do not. Their counterarguments are often rooted in statistical and logical reasoning. They point out that accidental drownings, particularly among young men who have consumed alcohol, are tragically common occurrences, especially in cities with extensive riverfronts or numerous waterways. Alcohol impairs judgment, coordination, and the ability to react to danger, making falls into water a statistically predictable, albeit heartbreaking, outcome. The sheer volume of bars and young people in these areas, combined with the proximity to water, creates a dangerous confluence of factors. Furthermore, critics emphasize the lack of concrete, verifiable forensic evidence linking these cases. There is no DNA evidence, no consistent weapon, no shared vehicle, no eyewitness testimony of abductions, and no definitive proof that the smiley face graffiti is anything more than common urban tagging. They argue that the graffiti, while unsettling, is ubiquitous in many urban environments and often appears randomly, without any connection to specific crimes. To attribute it as a serial killer's signature without direct, undeniable proof is, they contend, irresponsible and speculative. The FBI in particular has consistently maintained its position that there is no evidence of a serial killer or group responsible for these deaths. They have conducted extensive reviews of the cases presented by Gannon's team and concluded that the deaths, while tragic, are not linked by a common perpetrator or pattern of criminal activity. Their stance is that each case, while potentially unsolved as a homicide, does not fit the profile of a serial killer operating across multiple jurisdictions. They emphasize that the focus should remain on individual investigations rather than on a speculative, unproven conspiracy. Despite the official dismissals, the smiley face killer theory continues to resonate deeply with the grieving families. For them, the official explanations offer no true solace, no genuine closure. The inconsistencies they perceive, the baffling lack of answers, and the sheer volume of similar tragedies compel them to believe that something more sinister is at play. Their relentless advocacy, their tireless efforts to keep their loved ones' stories alive, stems from an agonizing need for truth, a desperate hope that one day the chilling silence will break and justice will finally be served. The enduring legacy of the smiley face killer mystery is multifaceted. It serves as a stark reminder of the profound vulnerability of young people, the terrifying power of the unknown, and the agonizing complexities of unsolved cases. It has sparked important conversations about public safety, the dangers of alcohol consumption, and the need for thorough, unbiased investigations. But perhaps most profoundly, it highlights the deep chasm that can exist between official narratives and the desperate, often heartbreaking, search for answers by those directly affected by tragedy. The river, that ancient, powerful artery, continues its relentless flow, its dark waters holding secrets that may never be fully revealed. The crude, grinning, smiley faces, whether a sinister signature or a mere coincidence, remain etched in the collective consciousness, a chilling symbol of a mystery that refuses to be forgotten. The whispers from the dark persist, carried on the cold, damp breezes, a haunting melody of questions without answers, a testament to the enduring power of an unsolved enigma that continues to grip the heartland. And so, the shadows lengthen, and the whispers grow louder, more insistent. The chilling tale of the smiley face killer conspiracy, with its perplexing deaths and haunting symbols, remains an open wound in the fabric of our reality. The search for truth, like the river itself, is a relentless, winding journey, often fraught with unseen dangers and profound, unsettling mysteries. And sometimes, the most terrifying truths are the ones that refuse to be officially acknowledged. Join me next time on Whispers from the Dark, as we journey into the enigmatic depths of the Bennington Triangle, where more chilling disappearances have defied explanation in the remote wilderness of Vermont.